Our scripture reading is in Isaiah 63. Isaiah 63, we'll read verses 1 through 6. Who is this who comes from Edom with garments of glowing colors from Bozra? This one who is majestic in his apparel, marching in the greatness of his strength. It is I who speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Why is your apparel red and your garments like the one who treads in the winepress? I have trodden the wine trough alone, and from the peoples there was no man with me. I also trod them in my anger and trampled them in my wrath. And their lifeblood is sprinkled on my garments, and I stained all my raiment. For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and my year of redemption has come. I looked, and there was no one to help, and I was astonished, and there was no one to uphold. So my own arm brought salvation to me, and my wrath upheld me. I trod down the peoples in my anger and made them drunk in my wrath, and I poured out their lifeblood on the earth.
If you have your Bibles, turn to Matthew chapter 8. We are returning to the life of Christ. And as I mentioned last week, we're going to spend some time in Matthew chapters 8 and 9 and 10 because there are a few really critical themes there following the Sermon on the Mount. Chuck read a chapter from the Old Testament that we're not going to look at, but it has a picture that I think ought to just arrest us. And the picture is Isaiah sees a man coming up from the nation of Edom. If you're not really keen on your Old Testament history, Edom, by the time of the life of the prophet Isaiah, Edom is kind of the last thorn in their side. Edom is descended from Esau. Israel's descended from Jacob, from Isaac. And Edom has been a lifelong enemy of Israel. And coming up out of Edom, this military foe, out of the city of Bozra, which at that time in history was a key city in Edom, Isaiah sees a soldier coming, a man. And it's odd. He doesn't know who this man is. And what's odd about it is the man's clothing is all splattered in blood. And so he asks the question, well, who is this person coming up across the border from Edom into Israel, covered in blood? And the answer is that it's the Messiah. It's the God-man prophesied centuries before his birth. And he is seen trampling the enemy of God's people so that they would be preserved. And he says that there was nobody to join him. He had to do it all by himself. And the blood on his garment is not his. It is the blood of his enemies. Then he gives a description of himself. He doesn't say, I am the coming Messiah or the Christ. He doesn't say, I am one day to be born and called Jesus. He says, I am mighty to save. It's a wonderful description in the midst of that picture. The people of God threatened. The people of God drifting. God's extraordinary mercy arriving on the scene. The hope is given. The God-man comes. What should we call him? Mighty to save. Now, the reason that I think that that is so important or so helpful is that we have just finished looking at Matthew chapter 5, 6 and 7, where the God-man as lawgiver and lawkeeper has commanded us what we must do and what we must not do. And anyone that takes the Sermon on the Mount seriously feels deeply within that we aren't up to the task and we need a Savior who is mighty to save. We need someone who doesn't just declare us right with God and the law at peace with us because of what he did, but whose work within us has a mighty beginning. But as wonderful as the new birth is, it's nothing compared to the end. And everything from the new birth to glorification, from the beginning to the completion of the rescue of a soul, is in the hands of Jesus of Nazareth, who just commanded us. And we need to see that the King who commands is also the King who heals or who continues the salvation. Otherwise, we would despair. And we would just have to say, well, I don't know anybody that keeps the Sermon on the Mount, takes it seriously. So that brings us to Matthew 8 and 9, because I think that what we see in Matthew 8 and 9 is a series of historical events. Miracles, primarily. Also some statements about discipleship. We'll get to those later. A series of miracles in Matthew chapter 8 and 9 that are given for a very particular purpose. And that purpose, I believe, is to demonstrate over and over from one angle after the next, from one viewpoint after the next. However you look at you, however you look at the Sermon on the Mount and what God expects of you and demands in our obedience, however you look at Christ, He is mighty to save. So you have everything you need in Him to do all His good pleasure. I don't know if you feel that you need this, but I feel that I need this, and I think that every believer feels they need this. And of course, those of you that stand at a distance from Christ so desperately need this. It's one thing to say that Christ is sufficient, He is willing, He is able. It's another thing to see it spelled out in the way that Matthew gives it. Now, I mentioned a few weeks ago that when we get to Matthew chapter 8 and 9, we find that this series of miracles is not, if I could say it this way, it's not in the right place. If you look at what Mark and Luke write, because you remember Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we call those the synoptic gospels. They see through the same lens. John writes much later and understands that you already have everything Matthew, Mark, and Luke wrote. And so John adds material that's not there. But for the most part, Matthew, Mark, and Luke are reporting the same events, and they are reporting them by the guidance of the Spirit of God and from different angles so that you can see the fullness of Christ and His work. But in Mark and in Luke, the miracles that appear in Matthew 8 and 9 do not follow, not all of them, they do not immediately follow the Sermon on the Mount. Some of them precede the Sermon on the Mount. Sermon on the Mount comes later in Jesus' Galilean ministry. You remember that Galilee is to the north of Jerusalem. It's kind of in the Jewish blue blood mind, Jerusalem, that's the important people. But spiritually, Galilee is a mixture. There's a lot of Gentiles that have mixed with Jews. Galilee is kind of the country bumpkin and the confused edge of spiritual Israel. But in the Old Testament, we were told that those that lived in Galilee would see a great light, and Christ has come. And so much of His ministry is not in the blue blood capital where the temple is in Jerusalem, but it is all around the Sea of Galilee. And we see this miracle occurring there. But these miracles, why are they out of place chronologically? Matthew knows that Mark has already probably been written and distributed. So it's not as if Matthew is a bad historian. If he's a fraudulent historian, he's a really stupid fraudulent historian, because all he had to do was look at what Mark said and look at what he said and think, oh, this is bad. I got him out of order. And so we've had 2000 years for Christians to adjust the Bible if they thought it needed to be adjusted. But Matthew has Mark, and he keeps this order. Chapter 8 and chapter 9, all these miracles lumped together that do not happen one after the next. This is not a chronological following of Christ's life. He's not saying this happened, then this, then this, then this. It's a thematic picture. And this is important, so I want to kind of stay here for a bit. Matthew also writes during a time when the vast majority of people who saw the leper and the centurion's child healed, servant healed, and the demons cast out, and the paralyzed healed, and the blind men healed. The vast majority of people who saw that were still alive when Matthew writes. If Matthew was confused, and this is an error, putting them in this order, then there would have been a lot of people alive who said, Matthew, why did you write it that way? That's not the way it happened. Matthew is writing a biography of Christ, and he stops after chapter 7. After giving three chapters of the Sermon on the Mount, the law restated by Christ, he then gives two chapters of miracles. If Matthew is not doing it chronologically, then why is it here? And more importantly, why does God have Matthew do this? It's one thing for Matthew to have a purpose. It's much more encouraging to see God's purpose. And I think that the purpose of God is almost more encouraging than the miracles themselves. I believe that Matthew 8 and 9, that the series of miracles lumped together is to clearly demonstrate to every person who just read 5, 6, and 7 that Christ is mighty to save, to heal, to do everything in and through his followers so that we might walk a path of obedience. Over the next couple of weeks, as we look at these miracles, each one of them seems to me, you could write, you know, the name of the miracle, the leper, the blind, the lame, the demon possessed, Peter's mother, who's just sick in the back room. And you could write over top that, mighty to save. So I want us to look at that, Christian, non-Christian, to see Christ from so many different angles that all our fears and our sluggish, half-hearted requests and our indifferent, you know, lackadaisical, casual seeking of the Lord, our proud drifting would all be laid in the dust when we see not just the law and what we owe him, and we're not as healthy as we thought we were, but also the healer, the mighty to save. Well, let's look at Matthew, and we're just going to look at the first of the miracles this morning. And it's the miracle of the leper, and we looked at this many months ago, but I want us to look at it again in verse 1 and going down through verse 4. When Jesus came down from the mountain, large crowds followed him, and a leper came to him and bowed down before him and said, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, I am willing, be cleansed. And immediately his leprosy was cleansed. And Jesus said to him, see that you tell no one, but go and show yourself to the priest and present the offering that Moses commanded as a testimony to them. So again, verse 1 is the historical introduction, but verse 2, following those next two chapters, we're not going historically, chronologically. So understanding the purpose of Matthew, the purpose of God, helps us understand how to apply it. How do we see what Christ does with a leper 2,000 years ago? And how does that have anything to do with us? What does Matthew reveal about Christ and you? And how does that change the way we live? Well, the miracle shows up not just here, but in Mark chapter 1 and Luke chapter 5, and we'll bounce around a little bit to see them, but we'll basically stay with Matthew. Well, first of all, let's consider the problem. The man was a leper, and I know that in church we hear lots about lepers and the healing of lepers, but actually in the Bible there are only a few examples of God healing a leper. A handful in the Old Testament, a handful in the New Testament. And while we can quickly flip back and forth, I've got a list of where they all occur in this. This is a commentary by a man named William Hendrickson, which if you don't have good New Testament commentaries, everything William Hendrickson wrote is really helpful. Hendrickson was actually a Presbyterian professor early on, mid 20th century. When we look at what happens here, I want us to think carefully about the nature of leprosy. Hendrickson met two modern medical missionaries who worked in the third world countries where leprosy was still prevalent. And in the mid last century, Hendrickson got them to sit down and give him a description of what leprosy actually looked like. I'm going to read you the description that he pulled together. All right. So hang with me. It's half a page. You ready? The disease, which we call leprosy, generally begins with pain in certain areas of the body. Numbness then follows. Soon the skin in such spots loses its original color. It gets thick and glossy and scaly. And that's where the Greek word lepros means, or lepus means a scale. So scaly skin. As the sickness progresses, the thickened spots become sores and ulcers because the blood supply doesn't reach them, so they begin to rot. The skin, especially around eyes and ears, begins to bunch up deep furrows between the swellings so that the face of the leper begins to resemble, you know, that of like a lion, like a lot of extra skin around their face. Fingers begin to drop off and toes. Eyebrows and eyelashes fall out. By this time, one can see that a person is in this pitiable condition. By a touch of the finger, one can feel it. You can even smell leprosy, for the leper emits a terrible odor. Moreover, in view of the fact that the disease-producing agent frequently also attacks the throat, the larynx, the leper's voice acquires this grating quality. His throat becomes hoarse, and you can now not only feel the leprosy and see the leprosy and smell the leprosy, but you can hear it in their voice. And if you stay with him for some time, you can even imagine, start to taste it. These are the doctors that worked with the leper colonies due to the odor. All the senses of a healthy person are engaged in the detection of a leper. That's the disease. It is an incurable disease, or at least it was in the Old Testament. Do you remember in 2 Kings 5, it says that the king of Aram sent one of his chief men, Naaman, to Israel to be healed of leprosy, because there was a Jewish slave who said, "Oh, I know a holy man that can heal." And so the king of Aram sends Naaman over. Now, when you read the accounts in 2 Kings, it's strange that the Israelite king who sees Naaman and receives the letter from the king of the Arameans who says, "I hear you have a healer that can heal leprosy. Well, here's this man. He's very important to me. You need to see that he gets healed." The king of Israel is bothered. He's afraid. He says, why does he send this man to me to get healed? Nobody can heal lepers. This is an attempt to initiate conflict. When I send Naaman back unhealed, it's going to be his excuse for attacking us. And the Arameans were much more powerful than the Israelites at this time. Leprosy was considered incurable. Of course, Naaman was cured. The rabbis in Jesus' day had a common saying. It is as difficult to cure a leper as it is to raise a dead man. The Old Testament is full of specific rules for lepers. And, you know, that's for medical protection, the isolation of the leper so that it doesn't spread. It wasn't that contagious of a disease, but it could be spread through touch. And also there was ceremonial or religious implications. Leviticus 13 is a chapter full of these. I just want to read two verses. It talks about the isolation of the leper. "As for the leper," verse 45, "who has the infection, his clothes are to be torn, the hair of his head is to be uncovered, and he will cover his mustache and cry out to everyone that gets close, 'Unclean, unclean.' He shall remain unclean all the days during which he has this infection. He is unclean. He shall live alone. His dwelling will be outside the camp." And so leper colonies were formed. In Luke chapter 17, we see an example of this. It says that when Christ was on his way to Jerusalem, he was passing between Samaria and Galilee, again, the north. As he entered a village, 10 leprous men, they're living together, who stood at a distance, met Christ. And they raised their voices, saying, "Jesus, Master, have mercy on us." You notice they don't come close. They stand at a distance and they're yelling over at Christ. Why? Because a leper wasn't allowed to get close to the crowds. A leper wasn't allowed to get close to their family. Once a person had leprosy and they were discovered, and you know, the things that you can imagine, you know, the symptoms beginning to be felt and the fear that this is leprosy, and eventually it becomes apparent it is. You had to go to a priest, and the priest had rules for declaring you a leper or not. You know, I mean, there was different types of baldness. If you read Leviticus, some types of baldness were obviously from leprosy and some weren't from leprosy. And so God gives all these specific directions. You go to the priest and the priest declares you a leper. You don't get to go back home. It's over. All friendships, all family, parents, children, spouse, you're separated forever. And you go outside of the city, you lose your job. There's no way to support yourself. There's no way to find food to eat. You have to beg. But when you beg, you can't get close to people. You just yell. And if there are doctors or if there are cures that you've heard that so-and-so has heard of a person that can cure leprosy, well, how do you get to them? The leper is isolated. And of course, there's the religious element. The emphasis in the Old Testament on leprosy is not the physical contagion, but that leprosy was a picture of a spiritual contagion. It didn't mean that the leper was particularly sinful. That came to be the thought. But as with other infectious diseases, you were ceremonially unclean. If you gave money to a beggar or food to a beggar who was a leper, so let's say you take them food and then you realize too late that you just handed food to the hand of a leper and they didn't tell you, then you couldn't go to church that week. And there was a whole series of things that had to be done by the law for you to be declared clean and to go back to church. All of that combined means that the leper in the culture of the day, there was a stigma. The sight of the leper, the smell of the leper, the sound of the leper, the very way that that disease impacted the leper created this kind of superstitious horror of lepers. And so many rules were added to the rules of the Bible to keep the leper far from society. That's leprosy. What did the leper do? Well, in Matthew 8 and then again in Mark 1 and Luke 5, we find that the leper presses in through the crowds. Can you imagine with the leper a very distinct look? In other passages, we find out the man is full of leprosy. That is, it hasn't just started. But this is a person that leprosy has been running through his body long enough that it's everywhere. He's full of it. There's no spots unaffected. So there he comes with that strange look and the smell and the robes that are torn and the missing fingers. And he comes up to Christ. Can you imagine the crowd's reception? The disciples' reception? I mean, we find the disciples, scolding people who interrupt Jesus because he's headed to the next town to preach. And the blind man says, "Jesus, have mercy on me." And the disciples say, "Shh, you know, Jesus is busy. Leave him alone." Can you imagine what they would have said when the leper comes into the crowd and people suddenly in horror rush back and all the crowd pushes back, and in the middle of the crowd, there's one person that doesn't move, and it's Christ. And if you read all three accounts, you find that what he did, first he falls on his knees, then he falls on his face, and he says this: "If you will, if you choose, you can heal me." I want to talk later about why that is such an extraordinary statement. You can heal me if you wish to. In other portions, in Mark and Luke, it's very clear. It's not just kind of a statement of fact, I know you're a great man sent from God. I've heard you've done so many miracles. So here's the facts. If you want to, you could heal me. But the other descriptions of this scene show clearly that while these are the words he used, it was in utter desperation. He is on his face in the dirt. And the stink is there and the sight of his decaying body is there. And he, in an advanced stage of leprosy, cries out desperately, "You know you can do it. If you wanted to, you could heal me." No bargains. "Jesus, if you heal me, I'd be willing to serve you forever." No entitlement. "Jesus, I got this disease. I'm not some kind of particularly bad sinner like the culture thinks that anybody that gets leprosy obviously was an especially wicked person. I haven't done anything to have earned this. I've lost everything. My life is miserable. Death would be easier. Jesus, don't you think you kind of owe it to me? Jesus, I've heard you've healed all these other kinds of ailments, but I haven't heard of any lepers yet. But aren't lepers deserving?" Just a simple statement, and I think it's a wonderful sinner's prayer. "You could heal me if you choose." And he leaves himself in the dirt, casting himself upon the mercy of Christ, leaving his fate in the hands of Jesus. Christ reaches out and touches him. Mark and Luke point out that Christ is moved with compassion. Later in Matthew 8, we're going to find Jesus healing a man from a great distance, or healing the servant from a great distance. He just speaks it and it happens in a far off town. He could have done that with the leper. But of course, he reaches out and he puts a hand on the diseased man and the rotting body that you can feel. And he heals him. And the power is not in his fingertips. It's in the compassion of God for the worst off. Christ heals him and then he gives him a command that has two parts. All right. He says to him in verse 4, "See that you tell no one." That's the first part. "But go," here's the second part, "and show yourself to the priest and present the offering that Moses commanded as a testimony to them." So two parts of the command. Why? Strange command. Not everybody's given this command. Later, when Christ heals 10 lepers, he doesn't give this command. Why this two-part command? Well, Matthew doesn't explain. Neither does Mark or Luke. But some things are probably discernible. And I think William Hendrickson, he kind of gathers the best explanations. And I think they all are very helpful. Let me give them to you quickly. First of all, Christ does not shortcut the law of God. And as the eternal Son of God, he is also lawgiver, as Father and Spirit. Christ does not shortcut the law of God just because he is God and he has done a great miracle. This man has been healed of leprosy. And he could say, God himself, in the person of his Son, touched and healed me. Who has ever heard of a leper in our day being healed? And he could have said, what use is it to go to a priest and to follow all those little petty rules for me to be declared clean? Obviously, I'm clean. Christ does not shortcut the law. He stays with the law. It will be fully fulfilled. These civil laws and ceremonial laws do pass away. But they are not passed away at this time, and Jesus Christ doesn't encourage the man to shortcut it. Second, in order for there to be a clear, manifest demonstration that Jesus of Nazareth is mighty to save, it will take more than this man going around saying, I once was a leper, but now I'm not a leper. Or even the crowd saying, that guy was a leper. Then he stood up and he wasn't a leper. Christ sends him immediately, without delay, to Jerusalem to meet with the priests, like Leviticus said, to be examined by the rules of Leviticus and to be declared either a leper or not a leper. One reason may be that if the Jewish authorities find out through the grapevine. Jesus of Nazareth just healed a leper in Galilee. Did you hear about it? If news reaches them before the leper who's been healed reaches them, would they be reluctant to declare this a genuine miracle? Would they say, well, we're not sure. Well, we can't really make a ruling on this. Because they know it would lift up Christ, exalt Christ, and they're not interested in any more people being impressed with Jesus. So that may be the reason. Go directly. Don't stop and talk to people. Go there. Be declared cured. And by the time they find out it was me that cured you, it'll be too late. There will be that objective evidence. But third, and we see this in Mark, when the man disregards Christ's commands for whatever motive, and his heart's so full, he just runs around and tells everybody what Christ has done for him. You can imagine, we aren't told who he tells, but I imagine he pretty much told everybody he could. Did he go back to his family first? You know, did he go to his parents? Did he go to his children and a wife if he had them? Did he go to his best friend? Did he go to his hometown that he's been separated for years? And then he goes down to Jerusalem and every person he sees, he stops them. It would be understandable, but Christ commanded him to be silent. He disregards the authority of the man that just healed him. And Luke and Mark point out that from that point forward, Jesus of Nazareth cannot minister in the cities any longer. Because there are these crowds of curious thrill seekers or crowds of people that say, hey, heal my friend. And when Christ has come to give the truth, the gospel of life, now the cities are packed full of people who just want to see another miracle or who want physical healing, but aren't really interested in the spiritual message. From this point forward, the ministry of Jesus Christ, in a sense, is restrained, limited by the disobedience of this man. He must stay outside the cities so that when people come to him, he can say the things that his Father has given him to say. There are a lot of lessons here for us, and I want to run through them. And I want to kind of approach them with this question. Will this nameless leper be your guide today, Christian or not? Will he be the guide to Christ, the healer, the mighty to save? Whether it's the 1,000th time you've gone to Christ, after reading Sermon on the Mount, you feel that there's still a lot of disease in you, or whether it's the first time you've gone to Christ. Will the leper in Matthew 8 be your guide today? Not tomorrow or eventually, now. Or will he be a witness against you on the day of judgment? When he stands glorified with all the believers and you stand far off, condemned for not letting him point you to Christ. Well, with that in mind, guide or witness against us, let me point out a few spiritual lessons. First, obviously, leprosy is a picture of sinful humanity here. Sinful Israel, sinful humanity, sinful us. Each of these pictures of Christ's power, mighty to save, it doesn't stop with the physical. The physical was a great act of mercy. But it points to something that goes deeper than that. Christ is able to rescue me and the leprosy that is spiritual, or the lameness, or the blindness, or the sickness that is spiritual. Think about the parallels. I think leprosy is a particularly descriptive disease when it comes to applying it morally. There is in every one of us, genetically, by birth, from Adam, we are born with a hidden condition, a disease that immediately begins to spread. It doesn't show itself in the same way in every person, but it does show itself in every person, and it does affect. The secret spread, the slow spread, the rotting areas of the body, the spiritual areas that are one after the next are starting to show themselves under the dominion of self-centeredness, self-worship. At first, maybe we become insensible like the leper. We can't really feel. That was one of the dangers. If your sense of touch is gone, then, you know, you're in danger of grabbing something or doing something that's dangerous. You don't even know it. The smell that comes up off the life when we live for ourselves, the humiliating isolation where sin enters into every good relationship that God gives humanity and it destroys it. Marriages are destroyed. Parent-children relationships are destroyed. Sibling relationships are destroyed. Friendships are destroyed. We are isolated from one another and we are isolated from God. We cannot draw near a holy God with this moral contamination. But whatever you say about the stink and the pain and the horror of seeing a leper is mild compared to what sin really is in the happiest looking of humans. I mean, you can look like you have it all together. You can be a quiet, sacrificial, friendly, kind person, but you have a leprosy. It is impacting your desires and your attitudes and your thoughts. It is showing itself in the larynx, in the voice, how you talk. It is touching every area. This internal disease runs throughout all humanity and destroys everything, rots everything that is beautiful. And Romans 8, you remember, says that this physical world groans under the weight of our sin. You could say this physical world groans under the weight of our spiritual leprosy. Every single person on the planet born a leper. You remember what Job said when he was describing the impossibility of any person, even Job, of being right with God by what we do? You know, if God were to let me, you know, he says, I can't even reach the courtroom of God. How am I going to present my case? And if God were to let me speak, my mouth, instead of defending me and justifying me, my mouth would turn against me when I face God. And my conscience, I would have to talk to myself. I would agree with God. Job says, if I could wash myself with water that comes from the melted snow of the mountains, so the cleanest water he knew of the day, my clothing would still abhor me. My clothes would cry out if they could and say, don't make us touch Job again. That foul man. Leprosy is a pale description of the impact of sin, not just in the things I mentioned, but in the ultimate result. That leper could have been a believer who hoped in the coming of Messiah and died before Jesus ever was incarnated, before Christ ever walked this earth, and would have been forever and ever, millions and millions and millions of years, and that isn't even the start, with God, clean, healed, adopted. But sin does not end its ruin when we die. And sin makes a person miserable and empty and the areas of life rot and isolation. And at the end of all that loss, you stand before God an enemy. And all the lies of sin are felt and the emptiness, and it's too late. The ultimate result is an everlasting isolation. Sin and leprosy, so similar. Let me give you another lesson. Maybe this will guide us to Christ. The leper pushes through so many obstacles in his day to get to Christ. We've kind of already mentioned it. Why? Why make the trip? Why risk the anger of the crowd? Why risk throwing yourself at the feet of Jesus of Nazareth, where you're too close for comfort and you've broken Leviticus? And why do you do it? Two things. He is convinced that there's no other hope for him. And he is convinced, strangely, that if Jesus wants to, he could heal him. Now, I want to point out something that I mentioned earlier, but told you I would talk about. How many lepers have been cured by Christ at this point? Well, I told you Matthew 8 is not the chronological place. It's we're in a biography, and it's like the biography says, next chapter, mighty to save. Let me give you some examples. But it's not a chronology. This is the first leper cured and recorded in the New Testament. We don't know of any other leper that Christ has cured. We know of demon-possessed people, and we know of lame people and blind people and all these other diseases. But at this point in Mark chapter 1 or Luke chapter 5, Christ has not cured any lepers, as far as we know. Do you see the hurdles he comes over? Who cares what my friends say? Who cares what the lepers say? They say, you can't go to Jesus. He's in a crowd. You can't get up in there. They'll kill you. Who cares what the fears that, well, maybe he won't even want to heal a person like you, especially once you ignore everything and get real close. He even overcomes the hurdle that no other leper has ever been healed by Christ. Well, of course, lame people and blind people and sick people have been healed. And of course, demons have been cast out. But we've never heard of a leper. And he overcomes every one of those fears and doubts and throws himself in the dirt and puts his face in the dirt in front of Jesus of Nazareth and only says one thing. If you want to, you could heal me, even though I've never heard of a leper being healed by this man. Of course, he's heard many things about him, you would think. Obviously, he's heard about his healing. But has he ever heard of a leper? Two things drive a man to Christ, and no obstacle comes between the man, the woman, the young person, and Christ if these two things are there. You feel that you're so needy, there's no other hope. Doesn't matter if other people delay. They're not as needy. You're needy. And Christ is able. Whether he's willing, you may not be sure, but he's able. And he's the only one. Have you ever wondered why we are so slow to run to Christ? Whether it's as a Christian to go back after sin, or whether it's you that stand at a distance from Christ and you just have all this religion and all this Bible knowledge, and you never run. Half-hearted prayers, casual approach, indifferent, seeking, kind of really not seeking, kind of wandering about religiously. And if you ran into Jesus, it would be okay with you. Why does he not delay, but we often delay? You have so much more than he had to give you confidence that Christ is not only able to save every type of sinner, to heal every kind of moral disease, but he is willing. He is able. He is willing. Doubt no more, we sing. Let me give you just a quick list. You have the explanations of Scripture. The entire Bible from Genesis to Revelation gives us scenes where we see God explaining, long before we see Christ in action, and after we see Christ in action, we hear God's explanations of what Christ will come to do. Genesis 3 to the end of Revelation, we see this from so many different angles. Why is he coming? What will he do? How will he accomplish it? Christ himself arrives, and the God-man turns to crowds, and he explains it to them. I have not come to do my own will, the will of him who sent me. What is that? To seek and to save those that wander spiritually lost. I have come to heal, not good people, but those that are sick, the ones that really need a doctor, not the ones that delay. You remember when he stood before the crowds and he quoted Isaiah 61? The Spirit of God is upon me. Why does Christ have the Spirit in fullness? Because the Lord has anointed me or equipped me, empowered me to bring good news to the afflicted. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, freedom to prisoners, the favorable year of the Lord. and the day of vengeance of our God, not against the sinner, but against the enemy of the sinner, to comfort all who mourn. Explanations. You have examples. I mentioned that this man, as far as we know, has no example of Christ healing a leper. You have biblical examples of Christ healing spiritual lepers. Whether it's King David, after a long, wonderful pattern of walking with the Lord as a young man all the way into adulthood, and all the promises God gave, and how David is a picture of a Christ figure, a representative of a people, a king, a protector. And then in light of all those mercies, David turns and embraces lust and arrogance and hypocrisy. Or whether you're looking at Peter, who follows Christ all those years, but still, even at the end, boasting in his own moral courage, and he fails. Or Paul, the very religious Pharisee, who said, outwardly, you couldn't point out one thing about my life to blame me for. I was outwardly blameless. But later he sees himself as he really is, a religious man who hates the God he says he worships. And he's conquered. Or you think of Manasseh in the Old Testament, child of Hezekiah, a godly dad. Manasseh is the most rebellious, wicked king of the Old Testament in many ways. He lives his entire life hating the God that Hezekiah loved, his dad loved. He lives his entire life rejecting and promoting idolatry. And at the end, God breaks his heart. And Manasseh repents and is fully forgiven for all of it. You have so many examples of lepers who came to Christ. Think about the examples you have in history. Augustine, arrogant young man, highly educated, dominated, he said, by lust. One woman after the next until God saved him. George Whitefield, he didn't grow up in a godly home with godly parents. Father died at an early age. Whitefield was raised in a pub, and he learned life by living in the bar and serving at the bar. George Mueller, so rebellious that while his father was a kind of an accountant and in charge of a number of people's financial accounts, Mueller was stealing from his father's clients. His father finds out and has to fire him. He's just working as a clerk. He gets fired and he leaves stealing more, and then goes from town to town in England, partying, getting drunk, doing everything he wants to do as a young man, and then goes to hotels and promises. So he has the night at the hotel. In the middle of the night, he sneaks out of the hotel before anybody's awake because he doesn't have any money. He gets captured and thrown into jail multiple times, and God saved Mueller. Or you can think about really nice people. Amy Carmichael, good Presbyterian girl growing up in a good home, but she is self-righteous and God saved her. He saves that kind of leper. Or you can think of John Newton, godly mother that taught him the Westminster Confession, died, left him under the care of an ungodly father, and Newton became a rank atheist. And God saved Newton, that kind of leper. You think of Hudson Taylor, again, growing up in a very godly home, a grandfather who heard John Wesley preach, was converted under Wesley's preaching. And because he became a Christian, the people in his town that knew he liked Wesley, a group of men jumped him in the night, a mob, beat him up and rubbed glass particles into his eyes. That was Hudson Taylor's grandfather. Hudson Taylor's father loved the Lord. Hudson Taylor's mother loves the Lord. Hudson Taylor's sister loves the Lord. They're all praying for him. But self-righteous Hudson Taylor was healed. I mean, you could just go through. You have so many examples. Why don't we run? Think of the commands. What if Matthew 8 was written differently? What if I could say to you, actually, in the other accounts, there's a whole lot more. In the other accounts, we find that Jesus sent the 12 disciples out with this message. Monday is leper day. If you're a leper, come Monday, I will heal you. If you're not sure that you're welcome on Monday, here are the symptoms. If you got these symptoms, come Monday, I'll heal you. Then you would understand why the leper shows up. But there is nothing like that. So in a sense, we would understand that the leper never risked it. But what about us? Christ has declared a day, today. Never does he say, you wait till tomorrow. Today is the day. Come today. Well, I'm not sure. Well, here are the symptoms. Those of you who are weary and heavy laden, you're sick of sin, you're sick of trying to carry a law you don't carry. Those of you who are stained, and the stain goes like a scarlet stain all through your life. Those of you who are dirty, there's a fountain for the dirty that's been opened. Those who are spiritually lame and you can't seem to change. You come to church, you hear a command, you see the picture of a Christian, you determine that you're going to go home and do better. You don't take a step. You never have. The blind, the dead, the deaf, the mute. What do you have to say about Christ other than what other people have already said? And you're like a parrot. But do you have any voice for Christ, really? Anything to say to the world about Christ? Every expression of sin we find summarized in these invitations. And the day is given today, spiritual lepers, and this is all the symptoms, and we still don't come. So the leper will either be a guide today, or he will be a witness against us at the end. How can you get a clear sight of yourself? Because that's the only difference between us and a leper here in this story, is that he felt things were bad. Nobody had to explain it to him. These weren't concepts. He saw the fingers lost. He knew he couldn't go back to family. He lived among the other lepers. He starves. He cries out at a distance for somebody to show enough pity to give him some food for the day. He knows, he feels the impact of a hopeless, incurable, fatal disease. We understand the concept. We're all sinners. But until you feel what it's doing to you and to those around you, till you feel that it's against God, you just won't come. There's always another idea. Let me try this first. God has given us a couple of really great tools to help. If you are indifferent to Christ, these are the tools I recommend to you. First, read the descriptions of God. See how vast a difference there is between you and your Creator. So that when you reject His words, you understand the seriousness of it. Read His commands. Sermon on the Mount. It's like that MRI machine. It's like a scan. We've all been very familiar with scans for cancer. We all have loved ones that have cancer. Penny has had so many scans. We're so grateful for the fact that these are clear. But you think about it. Without the law, you have a vague idea that you're not so healthy, right? You healthy? You want to go down the row and tell us how healthy? I mean, we're not healthy. But the law reveals how unhealthy. It reveals the existence of the disease and which areas are being touched by it. This is how I think we generally think. All right, we're all sinners. But actually, I'm in a church. And so while I know there's a few parts on this scan that would light up, most of the parts are pretty good. I mean, they're clear. So since it's just isolated, it's not that desperate yet. So you go to church and you come away feeling that it's just a couple of spots that have the disease. Yeah, there's some areas I'm not obeying God. I'd have to be honest. But hey, everybody has those. And then you take His word seriously for the first time, and God opens your eyes and your ears, and the Sermon on the Mount searches you like a scan. And you come to church and you expect the doctor, the sermon, to hold up a picture of you, and there's a few hot spots here and there, and you're lit up. And everything about you is lit up. This Sermon on the Mount, my motives were wrong. My approach to religion is wrong. The way I worry about life is wrong. The way I think about other people is wrong. My lusts are wrong. My greed is wrong. My bitterness is wrong. God, I am without hope. Every part of me is covered up. But because it's a concept, you're not shocked. Until God shows you. We've all been so grateful for penny scans. What if they had been different? What if this week Penny asked to talk to us after the service, and trying to control her voice, she says, "We got another scan. Everything. Cancer's everywhere." You would feel it. She would feel it. It's different than a concept. When you open the Word of God, will you plead with Him, "Make me to feel what's real"? But that's not the last tool. The last tool is the cross. My sins, my Savior, how sad on thee they fall. Seen through thy gentle patience, seen through the cross, I tenfold feel them all. Have you followed the perfect lawgiver through the cross and seen that it's your sin, it's your disease He's being crushed for, to the point that you don't just see the existence of sin by the MRI of the law, but you feel the nature of sin when you see the love of God? Sin is everywhere. How bad a deal is it? Sin is against this King. And you see Him at the cross and you think, every part of me is dominated by that which is hating Him. Is there any hope for a person like me? And you will go and throw yourself at the feet of Christ and you will ignore every obstacle. Think of the obstacles that are in front of you. There is what people around you would think, like for the leper. What will they think if I just say to Christ, "You can have everything"? What will my spouse think? We've had people who are converted or saved at the church who ran to Christ, and when they told their spouse was not happy. "I didn't marry a Christian. I don't want that kind of life." What will your children think if you come home and say, "We will live for Christ as much as I can help it. I will point us that way. I am Christ's"? Will your kids be happy? Will your friends at school be happy? Will your coworkers be happy? Will your church be happy? But you push through that if you're desperate and you know that He's able. Some of you have to push through your smattering of theology. You say, wait. God is sovereign, right? And God has predestined and God has elected. Yes, He has. What if someone would have met this man on the road and said, "You don't know for sure that it's God's will that you would be healed today. So why risk it?" But if you are desperate, I have never met one person who feels the true nature of their sin is against God and it's everywhere and feels that Christ has come to save the sinner. And today is the day, and my symptoms have been listed out in Scripture. And someone interrupts them and says, "But are you sure it's God's sovereign pleasure to rescue you today?" They don't stop for that question. That's a nice question for some other day. I have to be made right. Have you ever felt that sin is so horrific that it doesn't matter what God does to you, heaven, hell, all that, you don't want to live another minute for you? So you go to Christ, and everyone that tells you, "Well, I'm not sure if you're elect," you say to them, "We'll talk about it tomorrow. I've got to go to Christ today." Do you press through every obstacle? You will, when you have a clear sight of you, clear sight of Christ. Let me give a last application. The leper disregards Christ's command, and surely we can sympathize with the guy. His whole existence is different now. Family, friends, job, everything is different. Immediately and fully healed, everything is different. He can never go back to that old thing again. Everything is restored. Everything that was lost, everything that has racked his mind and memories and his emotions with loss, it's all restored in a way that no one would have ever thought. He is the first that we've heard of to be restored by Christ from leprosy. And he disobeys Christ and talks all the way. And we know that it restrains the ministry of Jesus in the cities from that point forward. There's a good lesson for us here. It's a secondary lesson, but it's important. If Christ heals you, your job is not to fix the world and to fill heaven. Your job is to obey your King, to walk with Him, happily surrendered to Him, depending on Him, sticking as close to Him as you can. And if you will do that, He will use you. And I think that every believer would be able to look back at the end of time and to see how God has so wonderfully used your example, your words, your efforts. But it is on the path of obedience and not on the path of our good ideas. Maybe the leper thought something like this. Jesus said not to tell anybody, but come on. I want everybody to know what a great Savior He is. And so he tells everybody on the way. And of course, it inhibits the ministry of Christ. Let me give you some ways that this could happen with us. God saves you, and you are so excited. And you're a baby Christian, and you say, I just want to lead a Bible study. And what if the older Christians say to you, well, that one day will be wonderful, but you're a young Christian now, let's wait. And you think, wait? These people, I don't even know if they're Christians. And you go somewhere where you can be in charge of worship or a Bible study. How much damage has been done? I think every older Christian can look back. I look back. Damage done by me thinking I was ready to take charge of everything long before I was ready. I ignored counsel. Did my wrong approach restrain the ministry of the gospel? If you bring half the gospel to the culture, and if we adjust church so the church is attractive to people that don't feel they need a Savior, but they do like to be part of a community, you do understand that we've stepped off the path of Christ's commands and we've done religion our own way. Don't be surprised when years later the people that attended the church no longer attend the church. And when someone tells them the gospel 20 years from now, they say, sorry, I've already tried that religion stuff. It didn't work. If we do the work of God by our own ideas of what will be effective or my feelings of what I want to do, it may be that the long-term consequences are that people are against the gospel because of what we did, or the gospel is restrained, or what one writer called the burned over district of living in an area where everybody's been baptized and everybody's prayed a sinner's prayer, but not everybody loves Christ. And when you talk to them, they interrupt you and say, I already have it. What do you mean? And they explain it, and you realize Christian ministry done in a wrong way has restrained the gospel. I'll give you another example. Social causes that we talked about. Social causes that have just such enormous consequence that it's extreme. Life and death in many of them. It is easy to step off the path of Christ, to quit obeying Him. The specific passages where He talks to us about how to talk to other people on His behalf, 1 Peter 3. So how do I say things that need to be said to a culture that doesn't want to hear it? The New Testament is full of very specific guidelines. But what if in the heat of the moment, in order to impress upon the people that are in your circle, what if you type something or say something to make an impression, to show them how serious it is, and you do it in a way that is completely counter to what Christ commands. Like this man, you may find that while you said true things, the way you said them, the tone, it makes the gospel hindered in their lives. From that point forward, all they remember is, I used to work with a Christian. I used to be on this chat group with one of those Christians, one of those Calvinists, one of whatever. And they were so horrible. I don't ever want to be one of them. What about the cage stage? You know what I mean? God teaches you a new truth from the Bible. A new doctrine seems to rise to the top. It doesn't have to be, you know, election or something, but that often is the case. And so you're gripped by this truth and you start to read your Bible and you see it from Genesis to Revelation because it's always been there, whatever it is. And you are so enamored with your new truth, with God, which God is teaching you, which you should be, that you think nobody else in the world knows it, and you become the prophet of that one thing. And you drive everyone nuts. And if you're not careful, you begin to overemphasize one of the beautiful truths of the Bible, and you do damage. And people kind of just turn their hearing aid off spiritually. And years later, when someone talks to them, they think, I've already heard enough of that religion. I had a friend that was this way. Final point. Aren't we grateful that when Christ heals a spiritual leper today, you are not commanded to go talk to Chuck or Steve or Ron or AC or John Diddy or myself first? You are allowed to tell everyone around you. You're allowed to tell your children about the Christ that forgave you of a lifetime of selfishness. You're allowed to tell your spouse. You're allowed to tell your coworkers. You're allowed to tell your classmates. You're allowed to tell the people sitting around you that Christ still is mighty to save. You don't have to hold on. In fact, you're commanded to go tell. And it shouldn't be a burden, but it ought to be seen in light of that man here. What a joy to run around the world, and as God gives me opportunities, to speak a word about my King. This is the first picture of Christ, mighty to save, for people who just saw how sick they were from Matthew in the Sermon on the Mount. Well, may the Lord help us to run to Him.